This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Well, hello, hello, hello. And this is not Richard Serrett, as you just heard. It is Victor Vigiani sitting in for Richard Serrett, who is, as we say, on assignment. And we'll find out probably in the next couple of weeks exactly what Richard is up to. Just giving some thought that almost every single day the world is, I guess, in a kind of funny kind of way, being confronted with mundane forces and psychic forces that are intimidating us, all of it intimating to those who are attentive that things just are not operating as we believe they should be, or more so, how we have been taught that they do operate. From politics to medicine, religion to philosophy, more and more information is coming at us and coming to light that the world and what lies beyond is not what we have been taught to expect. Some choose to ignore the adventure of exploring these matters, while others invite a different journey. You may have chosen to listen tonight for a lot of different reasons, but you are going to be hearing an escapade that examines the precarious, the risky, maybe, just maybe, everything we know is wrong. A chancy journey, maybe, yeah. And we welcome you along for the ride. My name is Victor Vigiani, and this is The Conspiracy Show. Along with a lot of the things that Richard does, he's been coming involved with some very different projects lately. And one of them that I'd like to talk to you about this evening is Sunday, November the 16th, 2014, this year, Richard is hosting a special all-day conference in Oshawa, Ontario. It's called Follow the Truth, the Conspiracy Show Summit. It will feature six incredible guests, including Roswell investigator Donald Schmidt, witness to the Roswell Forest UFO incident, Jim Peniston, physics professor Ronald Mallett to discuss time travel, and crop circle researcher Patty Greer, and also Jim Elveridge, author of Universe Solved, discusses the possibility that we're involved in a digitally manufactured programmed reality, otherwise known perhaps as the Matrix. That's Sunday, November the 16th at the Regent Theatre, 50 King Street East in Oshawa, Ontario. And if you're interested to look at some tickets, the box office number is 905-721-3399, extension 2. Or for more details, you can just email Follow the Truth Summit. That's followthetruthsummit@gmail.com. And as always, there is a website, and it's called followthetruth.tv. And that might be an interesting little project for you to consider this coming fall. This evening, the afterlife. something that is probably on our minds every once in a while when our head hits the pillow at night, or when the first thing happens in the morning, we think about what the day lies ahead and how things will work out. And eventually, when times of pensiveness come along, we always, I think, at least I do sometimes, think about my ultimate destiny. And this evening, we are going to be chatting with an expert in the afterlife, Dr. Stafford Beatty. And it will be something, I know, it'll challenge your perceptions about a lot of us have been brought up in different kinds of religious rites that have been, I guess, telling us what the afterlife is all about and what it might be. Dr. Beatty has a few different perceptions about what this afterlife is. And just by way of introduction, he has published 8 books and many articles and essays on a wide variety of subjects. The afterlife is very much on his mind these days, and he speaks at national conferences on life after death, and he also blogs for the Huffington Post. He believes the purpose of life is to grow one's soul, with the evolutionary goal of coming home to God, whatever God may prove to be, in a relationship that is challenging, joyous, never-ending, and never stagnant. His views on this subject have been formed not only by his religious scriptures or theology, but by the paranormal research that he's been involved in. His books, The Afterlife Unveiled and Heaven and Earth Unveiled, are products of this research. And his novel, his fictional novel, The Imprisoned Splendor, brings it to life in a very vivid fictional setting. Dr. Beatty, welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Thanks very much, Victor. It's great to be here. I feel honored.
Well, it's terrific. I'm honored to speak with you, too. In reviewing some of the work that you've done and looking at some of the references and all of the research you've done, you must be just, when did you start all of this work? How far back does it go? You must have done it from the cradle, for crying out loud.
In a sense, I did. I've been interested in the afterlife for an awfully long time. I remember as far back as when I was 10 years old, I began to wonder, you know, it is obvious that life is very short on this planet, and then there's an enormous amount of time that follows. I grasped that concept when I was 10, and I've always had a curiosity about what would follow, because it seems so much longer and ultimately more important than the journey that we're taking right here on the planet. So, yeah, and when I got to graduate school, I put that curiosity aside, and then when I got my teaching job here and got tenure, I began to bring it back up. It began to surface of its own self, and I've been going from that point on. I've been doing active research for the last 30 years on afterlife. Mm-hmm. And you're quite right to say that this research is not based on scripture. It's not based on religion. It's based on psychical research. Mm-hmm. You might call it well, we'll just leave it at that for the moment.
Okay, yeah, it's really something, because we take so much of this for granted all of the time, because most of us are growing up have been and taught in a culture, you know, be it Christianity or any other of the numerous religions that and cultures that are abundant on the planet, and they all have a very, very prescribed notion of what life and death is all about. And it's interesting that you mention the fact, you know, that being a teacher yourself and, you know, doing all of that kind of work. In my previous profession, I was a teacher too. I taught elementary school for a while, and was an educator after that for about 35 years. So I think one teacher talking to another is very significant in this conversation. What I want to find out, just very quickly, and just if you could, I'm going to throw something kind of broad. What is death?
Death is the shedding of the physical body. That's all it is. It's not mm-hmm. miraculous. The fact that we live on after what we call death is a very, in a sense, just a natural thing. It's God is not involved. No miracle is necessary. We just shed the outer body, and the inner body that we have within us right now, you might say it's just under the surface of the outer body, becomes the outer body. We can call that the astral body or the ethereal body or the subtle body. That's a word that Hindus use. And that becomes our body once we, quote, die. Of course, we don't really die, because consciousness doesn't stop.
So I guess in essence, the idea of death, things ending as far as the spirit or soul is really a misnomer. It just doesn't go away. It just doesn't fizzle out like a light goes out. It's just something continues.
Yeah. According to my research, and I've been researching this for a long time, the notion that we cease to exist at death, that, you know, once our brain stops, that's the end of us because the brain is the originator of all consciousness, that is, quote, the big lie. That's a huge mistake. You might call it a conspiracy.
Yeah.
That has become so prevalent. Mm-hmm. It's become the worldview of, quote, smart people, people who are, you know, with PhDs, scientists and the like. These people, in my view, are really pseudoscientists because they don't look at the literature that I am trying to share with the world and others like me. I'm not unique by any means. They just don't look at it. Professional philosophers, mm-hmm. Many scientists just refuse to look at it. They look down their nose before even examining it because they've heard from their peers that it's not worth looking at. Oh, what a mistake. And so they go into death, you might call it pessimistically. I certainly don't like the idea of extinction, I don't see any reason that they would either. But that's exactly what they do expect, and I believe that's no way to live. That's an ugly conspiracy that we are being forced to think that that's the cool way to think or the smart way to be.
Of course. The idea of them not looking at it is at their peril, I guess, because as soon as they start looking at things like that, all kinds of things come into play, like their pension and tenure. So they just don't touch it.
That's one of the reasons. Mm-hmm. They lose their respectability if they start. Yeah. If it becomes known that they are seriously considering a spiritual point of view, mm-hmm. that can cost them a great deal. It could cost them their career. I would have lost mine a long time ago had I not already been tenured and been promoted to full professor. I could afford to take risks, but I would not have taken the risk as a junior professor. I would have kept my interest to myself. Fortunately, the curiosity that has been kindled in me didn't really become strongly aroused until I was about 40 and had already gotten the tenure necessary to survive.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
Let me tell you that I am not a popular professor here among my peers. Mm-hmm. Among my students, yes, but not among my peers. They rather avoid me. They think I'm very peculiar.
I know the feeling. you mentioned that you first got involved in it when you were 40. I have to imagine that at some point in your life, be it latent or whatever, at whatever point in your life, that you may have discovered that some of the feelings or things you've been taught about life and death and that whole realm somehow didn't resonate with you. It's like a small stone in your shoe.
Right.
Was there something before the age of 40 that kind of kindled this feeling, or was
oh,
it?
Absolutely.
Was there,
long before that, Victor. As a matter of fact, the whole notion that there was this God who sat on a throne and had a scepter sitting in heaven and judging people and condemning people who didn't believe in Jesus or didn't believe in Allah or whatever it is you're supposed to believe in that will cost you eternal life, that just struck me as absurd. I mean, it really, by the time I was 25, I had rejected that belief wholesale. Unfortunately, I had to reject all Christianity as well for a while, and I lived the life of an agnostic, even an atheist, and I found that to be extremely unpleasant, and it really set me off on this adventure to find out if there was some way out of that very pessimistic worldview. And boy, did I find it. It's all over the place if you know where to look.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I've written my books. It's to share this worldview with as many people as I can reach.
Yeah,
that's only one of the problems with it. I mean, when you get into atonement theology and the notion of there being just one life and other aspects of my early upbringing, I began to question, and I found that there was very good reason to question them as I began to look at the evidence that was piling up.
Precisely. We have to take a bit of a break here, Doctor, just a few minutes, and we'll be back on the other side of the break. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Hey, we do invite your call, so feel free to call in. By the way, I need to also remind you that one of the other things that Richard is involved in is Season 3 of The Conspiracy Show on television. It's a program that debuts across Canada on Vision TV on August the 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And there are 13 brand new episodes, including the fake Arab Spring, Stanley Mayer's Water Engine, The Shroud of Turin, and Is the Cure for Cancer Being Suppressed? A lot of really vibrant things happening with Richard on television. We're really glad to see that happening with him. Also, too, if you want to become a member of the RichardSerrett.com Club, it's quick and easy and free. Just click on the blue membership area button on the right side of his website. Fill in the required fields and wait for your confirmation email. If you don't receive it, check back in your spam folder. It just might be hiding there. Once you're a member, you can gain access to member-only areas of the website, like the past show archives, and you also receive the Dead Drop newsletter, the official newsletter of The Conspiracy Show. Tonight, we're talking with a very, a prolific writer, first of all, and my understanding, a great teacher, Dr. Stafford Beatty, who's involved in the afterlife. And just before we get on with things, we talked about what death is in the corporeal sense, and it's not like turning a switch on and off, but there's a whole lot more to it than that. Let's get a little bit more into that. What I'd like to find out, if we could just sort of talk about for a second, this whole idea of growth. You talked about it, and I've heard you reference it before in terms of how the soul or the body or we as characters grow into the positions that we normally would achieve after death. What's this growth thing all about? We evolve into something different?
Yeah, this is a wonderful question, and it was the one that I was was urgently hoping you'd get to. According to spirit literature, dozens and dozens of accounts coming down to us over the last 160 years from the world of spirit through legitimate, authentic, and even classical mediums, book-length accounts of what life over there is like. These are my sources. According to them, the universe, the whole universe, wherever there are planets like Earth, is a moral gymnasium with challenges at every level, from what we find on Earth-like planets to what we have to endure in the Shadowlands if we have botched the adventure, or what we find in the highest heavens, which is hopefully where we're going to evolve into. The progress that spirits are allowed to make, we're not forced to. Our will is always free. We can resist progress. But the progress that spirits are allowed to make is striking, it's radical, it's far-reaching, and it can stretch over eons. Heaven is a vital, busy, challenging environment with extraordinary delights for those who are deserving, who are ready. It's not a lotus-eating paradise. It's not a place where you go to, quote, rest, as the Book of Revelation puts it at one place. One of the spirits puts it this way: we're pilgrims on an infinite march. I love that. So that is what we're looking forward to. And this is what we should be doing with our life right here and now, because right here is part of the march. We should be living life well. And my books will encourage you to do just that. There's a lot lying on the choices that we make here.
Let's examine just for a second some of this. You mentioned spirit sources. Let's look at that for a second. Sure. In terms of your own research, the work that you've done, there's other ways that you've become to know all of the things that you know. And to me, what you're doing is you're introducing a new language for us all to examine. You know, a concept is a concept only because it has language surrounding it. If the concept doesn't have language, then we really can't think about it in linguistic terms. So you're providing a brand new language for us to examine the possibilities that are very, very different than what we've been brought up to believe. The idea of your sources, where do you draw this information from?
Well, there have been many, many books, literally hundreds, probably thousands of books that have been published over the last 160 years. This process began around 1850 in Europe, incidentally, or rather in the United States, and then quickly into Europe, and particularly Britain. So the information comes from the spirits themselves, who are telling us about their life on the other side through these classical mediums. And the names of these mediums, you know, I can throw them out at you, and you may have heard of a few of them, but I doubt that most of your listeners have heard of any of them. Perhaps Jane Roberts would be the lone exception. She was the medium who channeled Seth. Also channeled, much more fascinatingly, a person claiming to be the philosopher and psychologist William James. But there are many others as well. Frederick Myers, for example, one of the founders of the Society for Psychical Research in 1882, he was brought through by Geraldine Cummins, the famous Irish medium, starting in the 1920s. And the book that she published, the two of them published together, it's called The Road to Immortality. It's considered to be the classic of this kind of genre. So, you know, all of this information comes from the world of spirit, and that's what makes it so fascinating to me and makes it more, you might say, more plausible, because spirits are closer to the source than we are. Truth for us is harder to get at because our physical brains sort of blinker out a great deal of the insight and of the revelation that spirits find themselves more easily accessing. So if we want to, you might say, give our religions a facelift, and all of our religions need a facelift, in my opinion, we should look to these sources, because they have a great deal to tell us that begins to make a heck of a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's, well, amazing. It really does, it sort of hits you broadside when you think about it, in terms of, you know, the daily life that we live and what we've been taught before. I keep on going back to that aspect of it, mm-hmm. because it is a really, it's a paradigm shift for everybody. My understanding of the world after death is it's the place that you land up in, you know, wherever that might be. It's sort of a function, and it's sort of dependent on the quality of one's own character.
Absolutely.
Yeah, while you're in this life. Talk to us about that for a second.
Yeah, what we call the law of karma, hey, those Hindus and Buddhists got that part right anyway. You find that attested to in every source I've ever read. The kind of experiences that await us in the world beyond death are totally dependent on the kind of character that we build on planets like ours here. Not necessarily only in this life, but in previous lives. In other words, the kind of being that we are, the essential self that we've molded ourselves into by choices, by habits that grow out of many, many choices, that's the kind of being. That's the kind of, in other words, our karma will be based on the kind of character that we are. It's not based on the individual deeds that we do in some corny tit-for-tat fashion. It's based on the kind of character that we are. Now, all of us have made mistakes, and we're going to be confronted with those mistakes when we find ourselves deceased. We will be confronted by our lives. We'll have to go back over those mistakes, and we'll learn from them, and they will be painful. We will find ourselves rather brutally judging ourselves. We don't need God to judge us. We will be judging ourselves when the blinkers fall off and we see what really motivated us to do the things that we did that we're not proud of. But the law of karma is very much in play, and the kind of experience and the kind of world that we will find ourselves in will be adjusted accordingly to the kind of being that we are. We will gravitate towards people like ourselves initially. And it doesn't mean we have to stay in the particular sector of the afterlife that we find ourselves gravitating to, but we will start out that way.
So does this change the nature of God as we know it? I'm just wondering. You mentioned that we judge ourselves, so it sort of dispossesses the idea that, you know, once you pass along, there's not going to be this man, as you said earlier, sitting on a throne, you know, with a hammer in his hand saying, you know, you're here and you're there. We are forced to look at God in a different way.
We are. God is not a judge who sits on that throne, as you put it. This is a childish way of looking at God. You might say this, that each of us has a tiny God component at the heart's deepest point. And so we see things with tremendous clarity once we shed the body. And that can be rather frightening if we've made a series of bad choices. We will begin to confront ourselves as we are. And what is doing confronting is that little that little God seed within us, what we call conscience here, it will be more available. It will be more awakened once we are, quote, dead. And so in that sense, God still is in play, but not as an outside force, but as an inner force, that little seed, that little God seed within us, doing the judging, doing the planning, doing, hopefully, the evolving, if we choose to evolve. And that's completely up to us.
So
it does make God look different, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does.
It makes God look a great deal more attractive and more plausible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're in essence, what I'm hearing from you is that we're more or less in control of our own fate.
We really are. And God is the source, in other words. And it's you know, he gives us this incredible gift of life and then the freedom to do with it what we want to, what we choose to do. That's a great gift. But he does not meddle much, if at all, in our lives. Prayers are effective, but in a way that we don't typically think of them. I can get to that if there's time.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, God needs to be reconceived and along much healthier, more plausible lines of thought.
Well, I guess in a lot of ways because of the of what we've been taught. I mean, people have been conditioned for centuries around this whole idea of religious notions of what heaven and hell and just you know, I was brought up a Catholic and I
Me
have
too.
Yeah, there you go. So, and I've shed a lot of those notions myself. I'm not sure, exactly sure how that happened. Perhaps it's some sort of divine intervention. I'm not quite sure. I look at myself as a very spiritual person, but institutional religion is dead as far as I'm concerned. But that's another story altogether.
Okay.
Yeah. What I'd like to do is maybe look at this idea of after we get to the place that we're at, there's all kinds of different levels that we yeah. experience. And you talk about jobs that we have to do once we cross that line into the other realm that that promote a different kind of a presence after we're there. What do you mean by that?
First of all, there are many occupations that are available to us. The heaven world, the good world, sometimes called Summerland. If we're decent people, we're going to find ourselves in a realm that, or a world that is attractive, that is lovely, and there will be many, many opportunities for the practice of loving service. And for those of us who want to evolve, we're going to have to get serious about loving service, more serious over there than we were here. We'll also find that it's more congenial to engage in loving service. It's a little bit easier to do that. But much will be required of us, much will be demanded of us if we want to evolve. We're not just allowed to sit back and, quote, be happy. And some of the loving service that we will be asked to do. For example, there are many varied expressions of it. There's the possibility that we will be helping out those materialists, or shall we call them physicalists, those people who deny anything like life after death, who find themselves very much alive, even though they've died, but with a tendency to deny that they really have died. This is remarkable. This mistake is referred to in source after source after source. So then people, hopefully like us, will be able to help these people recognize and accept the fact that they were profoundly wrong on Earth and that they have died and that they are still alive. And that's just one of the things that I find rather fascinating. That's one possible occupation. There's a great deal of, shall we say, counseling that goes on
over there. Yeah.
There's a lot of missionary work that's done. That's a word that I use. It's kind of a Christian twang to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a great deal of opportunity for service to those souls who are in dark places.
Stuff yet to be done, right?
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there, and I hope that I'll find that attractive and challenging, because that's a challenge that I think I would welcome. There are many forms. There are thousands of ways to grow one's soul on the other side, but it will require engaging occupational work.
We're talking with Dr. Stafford Beatty about the afterlife. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. My name is Victor Vigiani. Once again, thanks for joining us. And my name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to The Conspiracy Show. And we're talking this evening with Dr. Stafford Betty about the afterlife. And before we continue, I just want to give you some information about a really exciting conference or retreat that's coming up later on in August. And I think 28th to the 31st of August, it's going to be held over several days, and it's called the Extraterrestrial Intelligence and Consciousness Cosmic Connection Retreat. It'll be held just north of Toronto, and it's scheduled to be a really interesting several couple of days. So it'll involve Daniel P. Sheehan, if you're familiar with Daniel's work, Grant Cameron, Canadian researcher, and disclosure advocate Stephen G. Bassett, and I will be showing up there too. So if you want more information about the extraterrestrial intelligence and the consciousness cosmic connection, go to ufocontact.com/retreat, or you can contact the organizers at info@ufocontact.com. Back to the questions, a broader concern. It's something that I think has been explored by other people, but not necessarily, so much so in terms of religion. But some communication spirits have spoken about an eternal life, Doctor, and others speak of rebirth, coming back to learn more. The obvious example being in the books of Anthony Borgia. Why is that? What's the whole difference between the eternal life and others coming back with some sort of rebirth or reincarnation or whatever they might call it? How does that fit into to the frame and paradigms you've been examining?
Yeah. Keep in mind that the world ahead of us it provides opportunities for every wholesome interest or avocation, from science to music to theology, astral architecture, home building. It's a joyful, endlessly fascinating place full of challenges for those who desire to grow. However, for those who are not up to the kind of hyper-spiritual life that the more mature would find bracing and delightful and attractive enough not to feel the need to return to Earth to experience more basic satisfactions and experiences, that's a possibility. One does not have to reincarnate. I would hope not to have to reincarnate myself, but it's very likely that I will not have worked out all of the problems in my nature that one has to before moving on. Probably I'll have to, but one doesn't have to, and the ideal is to not have to and to keep moving forward. So that sort of puts reincarnation into its proper context. It's a great way to, you might say, grow at an accelerated rate. The challenges here at this level, mm-hmm. at the level of a planet like our own, is great. I mean, we have to worry about death. We have to worry about just surviving. This calls forth either great virtue for those of us who choose well, or great vice for those of us who choose selfishly. So it's a place, it's a moral gymnasium, as I said before. And it's ideally set up for advanced training into the world of spirit, where mm-hmm. eventually and hopefully we will stay.
I love that term, moral gymnasium. It's an incredible concept. It's all part of that new language that we have to confront in order to understand this concept. Let me spend a second asking you, you mentioned that, so there's hyper-spirituality, and those of us who grasp the concept, we can get it. We know that something has to be done. What about individuals, be they mentally challenged or physically challenged or intellectually challenged in one way or another, in my profession, meeting children at that level, even adults too, they really don't have an idea of their own self-awareness. They might, but we just don't know that they do.
Right.
How would you imagine these individuals would fit into the whole idea that you're talking about?
Right. Let's first of all talk about kids. Mm-hmm. Children, toddlers even, individuals who die at an early age, what happens to them? They are taken over after becoming orphaned, orphaned in reverse. You know, their parents haven't died, they've died, and their parents are back on Earth. Well, what happens to these kids? They are loved and nurtured by souls who delight in mothering or occasionally even fathering orphaned children on the other side. That's one of the professions, one of the jobs that is often chosen by spirits who have enjoyed children back on Earth. So they continue to give their gifts to the children of spirit on the other side, and the spirits grow into adults under the careful, nurturing presences of these motherly beings.
Doctor, could I hold you there for a second? I want to continue this right after the break because I find it fascinating. Once again, my name is Victor Vigiani, and this is The Conspiracy Show, and stay exactly where you are. Just before the break, we were talking about how children are dealt with, specifically those children who pass away before their parents do and have been denied the care that their natural parents would normally give them. And, Doctor, you were talking about others that might take over this role.
Yeah, that's right. And you mentioned also adults, for example, mm-hmm. who've been harmed, or mentally retarded people, people who are born with very low IQs and so forth. I think that was part of your question as well, Victor. Did I get that right?
That's correct, Doctor.
Right. You know, it would be folly to try to guess exactly why those things happened to that particular individual, and I don't want to get into that.
Of course.
But there certainly would be the opportunity to grow in one way or another in those incapacitated states. The soul is not dormant. The soul is undergoing whatever experience it is really like to be in that kind of condition. I don't know what that condition feels like, but the soul is there undergoing it and will grow from it, probably without doing too much choosing, because there isn't much ability to choose in these very unadvanced states. So we'll just leave that question unanswered, and it is mysterious, but in the last analysis, the overall picture of the afterlife is that we're all left, in other words, we're left with a picture of the growing immensity and grandeur of the human soul when it responds continually to the call from its infinitely mighty and gracious Maker. That's what we're all called to do when we have the capacity to make those kinds of choices. And, of course, some individuals don't have that capacity. But you and I do, Victor, mm-hmm. and most of the listeners also have that capacity. And it's the way we choose now in this particular life that's going to have everything to do with our progress in the world ahead.
Yeah, it's a fascinating notion, and it takes a bit of courage to admit a question like that is kind of unanswerable in a lot of ways,
yeah.
because you don't want to get too far into the area of speculation on a matter so important like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Of course. The other thing that I want to address with you is the whole idea, and I keep on going back to the notion of how we've been taught about these things as Christians
yeah.
and others who believe in, who are, you know, of other faiths.
Sure.
The ideas of heaven and hell and, you know, the idea of purgatory, and this thing called limbo, which I never really understood. Are these all strictly contrived and interpretive notions of the Bible or inspiration? And I guess my question to you is, how could biblical scholars be so darn wrong about all this stuff?
It's not biblical scholars who are wrong. It's the relatively primitive people who put together these systems thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, and we're stuck with them. And that's a shame. That's one of the problems with having a scripture. We don't grow beyond the scripture. And what I learned to do very early in life was to not get hemmed in by the scriptural passages that don't make any sense. There are wonderful passages in the Bible. For example, Matthew 5-7, Christ's Sermon on the Mount. It doesn't get any better than that. That's the wisdom that we find in the very spirits that I've been studying that I want to share with my readers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal about Christianity in particular that is good. And I don't discourage people from going to church at all. I think it's probably something on the whole that is good for them to do. But there's also, I hate to say this, but there's quite a bit of nonsense in in the doctrine that I was raised with. At least that's the way I have come to believe it. Without going into particulars, there are things that I just leave behind. But there are also many wonderful passages in the Bible that we would be wise to study and live by. But I don't know, it's just human nature to get stuck in tradition and be afraid to move on. And that's the way most of us are. I'm just not that way. And Victor, you broke through somehow yourself. You're not sure how that happened, you said.
That's right.
But and the same way, I just have had the courage to break out of those manacles that keep us believing that there are certain formulas that we have to buy into, that we have to accept in order to be saved. That's just not what comes through any of the accounts that I've studied.
Yeah.
None of these formulas are going to save you.
Of course.
There are no rigid creeds on the other side that you have to adopt in order to be saved. And whether you're a Baptist or a Catholic or a Mormon or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim or an Anglican is simply of no importance over there.
Yeah.
Many of Earth's favorite religious dogmas are off the mark anyway, and the sooner they are recognized as such, the better.
The better. You've raised an issue. I want to, you know, get to 2 points before we break off here. The first
sure.
one is about Christ and what or who he was. And second of all, before I get to that one, and just very briefly, could you just sort of address the issue of, you know, you write many religions are represented in the spirit worlds, and I suspect that our audience would really like to know more about how this whole idea of sectarian strife that we're going through right now, how does that play out in whatever that next place is? Do people have different...
Oh, wow, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
First of all, the heaven worlds that the decent among us are destined for soon after our death is divided into many, many sectors. We're not going to find ourselves, if we have been happy Catholics and die as Catholic, we're not going to find ourselves in a world that is populated by Muslims. Muslims will find themselves in their own world, in their own sector of heaven, and we'll find ourselves in the sector of heaven that we, where people who think like us will welcome us and love us. Now, there will come a point when we start outgrowing the boundaries of these various sectors, and we grow into a kind of a meta-religion or a kind of a universal faith as we, you might say, discard the limiting religions that we carry over with us into the other world. The best, the wisest among us will discard those cramping conditions and move into something far better that that represents the wisdom and the experience of higher spirits.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there are sectors, and there are many sectors, and there are probably thousands of them. So that's an interesting concept that I did not come across in my religious training as a boy.
For sure. I guess the other idea, too, is I've always been enthralled by the persona of this man named Jesus, and you know where he came from, what he meant. How does he factor into all of this, or that entity?
Jesus, this is wonderful. Jesus is loved by those Christians who loved him here. They will want to see him, and from the accounts I've read, they will be enabled to see at least something that they take to be Jesus. And they will delight in seeing Jesus. But they will not be his disciples anymore in the sense that they were here. They grow into something different from that. Jesus himself is regarded as a kind of master spirit, as one of the great teachers of the afterlife, someone who lives on a much higher plane than we're going to find ourselves on shortly after we die. We have access to him, as I said, if we want access to him. But he is not regarded as God. There's nothing like the Trinity that one finds in any of these accounts. There's nothing like the notion of an atonement theology, that Jesus had to die on the cross for us, for our sins to be forgiven by, you might say, a jealous Father God who requires it of us. There's nothing like that. These old dogmas simply aren't found in spirit literature. So Jesus is not God, but he is greatly loved and admired and turned to by those who desire to turn to him over there. He's available in some sense, but as a master spirit, as a kind of a messiah, as one of the great teachers of the other world. But he's not alone. He's not the only great teacher over there. Not at all.
Part of a chorus, I guess.
Yeah.
Also, to the idea of good and evil. I mean, it's so prevalent in our day-to-day society, in the corporeal sense that we exist, and you know, that the strife and the angst that exists between those two polemic concepts. Where does good and evil fit in? I mean, is there a good, ultimate good? Is there an ultimate evil? Do they continue to work against each other, or do they dissolve into some other concept that just makes evil non-existent anymore?
Right. There's no Satan over there. Some of the accounts explicitly say that. But there are many very selfish, cruel souls over there, the very ones we have encountered in our own world. They don't change just because they die. They don't become good just because they shed the body.
I see.
They gravitate to places where souls like them are, you might say, are to be found. And sometimes these worlds are called the, I don't know, it has a different, very many different names. Almost never is the word hell used to denote the place where they gravitate towards. These, there is no ultimate evil that's going to triumph. That is not a concept that one runs into at all in this literature. If anything, the spirits who are in these shadow realms, that's what they're sometimes called, need our help. They need spirits to come down them and help them to move out of the dark world into the light. So there is no permanent condemnation.
Yeah.
These souls will move out of their realms as soon as they're ready to.
I see.
And many will not be ready to for a long time.
It's like your idea of the moral gymnasium. You know, we're all playing on the gym floor, and these other poor souls are sitting on the sideline.
That's exactly right. They just don't want to move. They're just that's a wonderful analogy, Victor. Thank you.
Yeah. You've mentioned it three times now already. You've mentioned this planet that we are on. I am someone who has become very intensely involved in the idea of extraterrestrial consciousness.
Okay.
and life beyond our planet, sentient life beyond the planet. And I believe that we are being engaged by these off-world civilizations.
Okay.
When you mentioned on this planet, and even the Catholic Church has come out to say that there may in fact be other kinds of intelligent life out there, and we should welcome them. How do you see the universal or cosmic aspects of this in terms of extraterrestrial intelligence joining into this whole symphony of this other place after we all pass?
Yeah, that's great. Let me just turn to, if I can find this, I want to share it with you, because there are a couple of...
We just have a few minutes left, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of explicit mentions of these worlds. I can't find it, but the experience we're having on this particular planet is regarded as quite similar to the experiences of others on other planets in other solar systems, galaxies, whatever. So it's not as if, you know, planet Earth is the only moral gymnasium. There are many. As a matter of fact, everywhere where there is conscious life and the ability to choose, there you find other moral gymnasiums throughout the entire universe. The whole point of living in these worlds is to grow our souls and to become more divine as we go deeper into what we essentially are and realize our destiny.
I see. It just sort of adds a new dimension to the kinds of things that I've been investigating, because it seems to me that the whole cosmic reality of what we're involved in, and if we do believe in some sort of creator or the one, it just seems like it should all fold in together at some point with all of
us
being engaged in. In any case, I do want to thank you so very much this evening, Doctor, for joining us. You've enlightened me for sure, and I hope that you've given some food for thought and planted some seeds for our listeners this evening. So is there any website that you want to mention or anything else that you want to talk about before we just sort of leave?
Well, I just I probably ought to spell my last name. It's Betty. It's just like a woman's first name.
Mm-hmm.
Often I'm mistaken as a Betty Stafford, as a woman, but my name is Stafford Betty, and these books, the most recent one, The Heaven and Hell Unveiled, and the other one, The Afterlife Unveiled, are available probably most easily at Amazon.com. Just, you know, type in my name, Stafford Betty, and they'll turn up, and you'll learn all about them. They have been reviewed many times, and you can decide whether or not it's worth purchasing them. They're both of them inexpensive.
Well, once again, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and maybe we look forward to another session with you so we can dig down and drill deeper into this whole idea of where we go after these little vessels have spent their time. Thank you very much for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you, Victor. You've been a very fine host.
Good night. Well, wasn't that something? I'm not sure where you go from there. I know you've got a lot to think about. Continue to do that. Thank you for listening. My name is Victor Vigiani. You've been listening to The Conspiracy Show. Well, good evening once again. This is not Richard Serrett, as the intro did talk about. My name is Victor Vigiani, sitting in for Richard, who is, as they say, on assignment. Quite often, the world that we're presented with, and it's, I guess, mundane daily affairs, and even psychic forces appear to be forcing us, like, be attentive to something that we may not really recognize, and that is probably that we're not operating in a system that we fully realize and consciously understand. As a matter of fact, just about everything, at least I'm beginning to understand, is just, it's not the way it really is. And this whole idea of a matrix, that we might be living someplace beyond, or at least there is something else beyond where we are, comes into play a lot, be it politics or medicine, religion or philosophy. More information is coming to light that the world that we see and what lies beyond is really nothing like it really should be or expect. I guess some of those people who are listening this evening, I guess you're reluctant to take those matters on, to really kind of challenge yourself, to kind of push forward. And that's quite all right. You know, we can all reside in the places that we're comfortable. But others invite a different journey. And for those of you who are listening tonight that want to take a different journey, we will be investigating the perilous, the precarious, the risky, and just maybe realizing that everything we know is wrong, or at least badly incorrect. It's a chancy journey, and we welcome you along for that ride. Join us, will you? My name is Victor Vigiani, and you are listening to The Conspiracy Show. This evening, our guest is Dr. Allison Adams. Dr. Allison is a qualified dentist in London. She qualified as a dentist in London in 1983, and after working for a number of years, later obtained a master's degree in restorative dentistry from the University of Michigan in 1992. She worked as a dentist for 20 years in total, and latterly running her own private dental practice in central London. Personally, she had poor health all of her life, and she was medicated from early childhood and has 21 surgeries to date, as scars on, I guess, on her gun handle. A health crisis a decade ago brought about a mercury spill in her office, forced her to quit dentistry and to seek answers to her own mounting health problems. Informal study into natural medicine turned into formal courses of study at different ideas of kinesiology and allergy therapy. She's now largely recovered from what she has known as an occupational poisoning of mercury, and has written about chronic fatigue syndrome. We want to welcome to The Conspiracy Show Dr. Allison Adams. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Victor. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, great of you to join us. So it sounds like you've been through a lot, my friend. My goodness.
I have. I think it's undeniable at this point in my life that my health has been the overarching factor in my life, sadly.
How do you rebound from something like that? I mean, I get the flu and I feel like just sort of totally giving up. And you've been through so much, and you've managed to to recover, I guess, in mind and body and spirit, and do some things that are pretty provocative.
Well, I mean, I think what you mentioned that I'd written a book about chronic fatigue. I don't believe in the flu as we would understand it. I think a flu and a cold is a detox. And actually, chronic fatigue is just massive toxicity, and you feel like you've got the flu all the time, because a lot of people just don't get chronic fatigue. They think it's, you know, psychosomatic and all this sort of thing.
So when I'm sick, I'm getting better?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, that's the body's process for cleansing your body. So you should... that's the one thing I would want listeners to take away from this is don't suppress symptoms. Your body is far, far smarter, you know, than we can possibly imagine. You were saying in the intro that we've all been misled about lots of things, and this has been my journey of trying to, you know, uncover things and realizing that a lot of what we receive wisdom is actually backwards. Yes, but once you actually, of course, I was taught the allopathic system going mm-hmm. through medical school and all the rest of it, but the naturopathic system, once you know that, that makes it just makes complete sense, and you know that that is the truth, and the allopathic system is basically a lie.
Let's spend a minute on that in terms of what we've been told. A lot of the kinds of things that we talk about on this program, we use the word conspiracy, and it's a strong word. It's a very, very strong word. However, it applies to so much of what we've been naturally led to believe as children and young adults, and we become sort of totally ingrained to these ideas, and we have a real great difficulty in changing our mindset to accept another paradigm of reality. Why do you think the medical profession, and I guess perhaps other professions, other related professions, have been so stridently avoiding the ideas of what you've just been mentioning in terms of alternate forms of medicine or alternate forms of healing or alternate forms of health that bring you to the same place or the place that you deserve to be in terms of your own health?
Yes, I did actually approach the show because I have listened for a long time to the conspiracy show, but in my research I've actually come to really understand over 12 years or something of digging into this matter that this is a conspiracy. You can't come away with anything but that conclusion, really, when you look into the history of things and, you know, quite how these things work, I don't know, but, you know, again and again there have mm-hmm. been committees and, you know, they've decided in favor of the status quo or, you know, books or research that have been written or done or whatever have been hushed up or never taught about. I mean, mm-hmm. most of the stuff I know now I had no exposure to during my training. 7 years at, you know, supposedly two of the best dental schools in the world. So I don't know. I mean, I think it starts young, and you know, the Jesuit saying that, you know, give me a child until he's seven and I'll show you the man. I mean, most people don't fundamentally change their concepts about anything, it is said, you know, past mm-hmm. the age of seven. It's very confronting, and it was very confronting for me, and the only reason I was willing to do it was because I absolutely knew I'd exhausted what allopathic medicine had to offer me and that I was going to die if I didn't find a solution. So, you know, that made me open. But, you know, I will willingly admit I bristled at a lot of the ideas that I now am espousing, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Of course.
Because of my training, because of what we've been taught. And, you know, I think if you talk to most doctors or dentists, they will tell you that at their school they were taught, this is all you need to know. Don't look outside of this paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, everything else is quackery. They love that word. You know, and they don't know. They simply don't know some of this information. Mm-hmm. And they don't know that what they perceive as incurable diseases can be cured because they're not seeing it within their, you know, in their frame of
yeah.
reference.
It's almost like, if there's anything, the training that I received, I was a teacher by profession and as a, you know, after that, an elementary school principal. I went through 2 years of training as an educator, as a teacher, and after that, once I got into the educational community, I realized that I was carrying around like a huge stone tablet on my back with it, everything sort of written in stone. And it was about 2 years into that profession that I realized that I had to unshackle myself from that tablet that was hanging around my neck for at least 4 years into my profession. And once I relieved myself of that tablet, of all that stuff that was written in stone, I felt the sense of freedom to explore things and go at it from a totally different perspective. Was that sort of your idea as to how you sort of moved into this alternative way of looking at medicine?
Yes, on that subject, do you know of John Taylor Gatto? Have you heard of him?
I have heard it. Yes, I have. Yes, I mean, as a matter of fact.
He's an interesting man, but he too was in education and completely rethought everything he'd been taught, and he's quite an entertaining person to listen to. I just think everything we're exposed to, is fairly carefully controlled, I'm actually just doing an article, which I'll publish in the next couple of days, but about the harassing of natural medical and dental practitioners because, they get given a really hard time, and many of them flee North America. They have armed raids on their offices all the time, and, they're dragged through disciplinary proceedings and that sort of thing. So the message is that, you don't need to raid a natural practitioner's place with armed guards, a SWAT team of 725 people. It's ridiculous. It's done to scare the living daylights out of people and to discourage everybody else from stepping outside of beyond the line that's been laid down. And of course, all of this is strictly enforced by all the General Dental Council in the UK or the American Dental Association or whatever. So there is a standard of care, and you have to stick to that. As I imagine, the same with teaching. It's done. And that also doesn't allow for any innovation. The innovation is then supposed to come out of the dental schools, but, the people least likely to innovate are the people who have sucked it all up, regurgitated it and proceeded and been promoted by the system.
Right.
They're never going to see outside of the box. They're really not.
Of course. While we're listening, I just want to point out to the audience that your website, I'll mention it here for you, www.mouthbodydoctor.com. So if you're near a computer and you want to follow along with us, some of the ideas that the doctor is talking about, we more than invite you to tag along with us. Before we launch into some of the more specifics of the kinds of things that we posted on Richard's website in terms of mercury, etc., I just want to mention to you something that I think is relevant to all of this. Those of us who have been involved with the dental profession in the past, it has been something of a scary notion. And when I was very, very young, my dad brought me to a dentist. His name was Dr. White. He's long gone. But I began to fear that whole concept of going to some place where someone put metal things in your mouth and then did things to you. We're going to break here for a second, but I want you to think about that during the break, Doctor, because there are people out there who are in abject fear of dentistry, of dentists. And I want to address that issue before we move along, because it is something of almost a passionate feeling among a lot of the people that are listening right now. So after the break, we'll get more into that. We're listening to The Conspiracy Show, and my name is Victor Vigiani. Stay with us. There are a number of things that I'd like to bring our listeners up to date with. One particular really exciting thing that's happening with Richard over the next little while, actually this fall. On Sunday, November the 16th, Richard is hosting a special all-day conference in Oshawa, Ontario. It's called Follow the Truth, The Conspiracy Show Summit. It will feature six incredible speakers, including Roswell investigator Don Schmidt, a witness to the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, former Sergeant Jim Penniston, physics professor Ronald Mallett, to discuss time travel, and also crop circle research expert Patty Greer, as well as Jim Eldridge, author of Universe Solved, discussing the possibility we're all living in a digital program reality called The Matrix. That's Sunday, November the 16th at the Regent Theater, 50 King Street East in Oshawa, Ontario. And if you want to get hold of tickets, the box office number is 905-721-3399, extension 2. Or you can just go to the website followthetruth.tv. And you'll be hooked into one of Richard's new enterprises. And there are going to be other places that he's going to be visiting over the, I guess, even in the North American continent as an extension of the Follow the Truth, and we're looking forward to that. This evening, we're talking to a very interesting individual who has, I guess, had some very different kinds of insights into the dentistry profession. And Doctor, we were talking about the, Dr. Allison, we were talking about the idea just before the break, and I raised the issue of the fear aspect of that a lot of people psychologically go through in terms of getting to the dentist to the detriment of their own health. What's this all about? Does it have to do with pain? Does it have to do with some psychological notion? What's that all about? Because I went through a lot of that myself personally.
I think it's totally legitimate.
So I wasn't wrong.
I think there's nothing normal about being taken to an office and having somebody in a white coat, you know, stick needles in you, drill your teeth, et cetera, et cetera. None of this has happened. You know, if people are in their native environment eating their native foods, gazelles don't need dentists. You know, chimps don't need dentists unless they're, you know, caged and being given the wrong foods. And it's the same with humans. We shouldn't need any of this. And there was work done by a dentist researcher nearly 100 years ago called Weston Price, and he went round all the far-flung places of the world where they'd never seen a white man before, and he actually catalogued their health while they were eating their native diet, and then he was on site when the Western foods, all the processed foods and the sugar and, you know, all the rest of it started arriving.
Right.
And their health just fell apart in a matter of just a few years. And the health of their children as well, if the mothers were pregnant while they were eating that food. And it was only then that they started getting tooth decay and gum disease. So, you know, throughout our hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, we haven't needed dentists and we haven't had dental disease. It's a very modern thing. And you were talking before about, you know, manipulation, conspiracies and things, but I think our perception of what is normal is how, you know, that's the prevailing way the system works. You know, if you're eating your diet, you really shouldn't be getting disease. You shouldn't be needing checkups every 6 months and cleanings and all the rest of it. You should maintain your mouth in health. It should grow to accommodate all of your teeth, not needing braces, not needing your wisdom teeth out. We're all malformed now. You know, we're actually really quite sick. You know,
not a pretty scenario, no.
It's normal. Say again?
Not a pretty scenario.
It's not. And, you know, it's really quite distressing when you realize the magnitude of it.
Mm. Yeah, you talked about the work of Dr. Price and discovering that, you know, literally generations virtually free of that kind of dental problem, even health problems too. But then when Western, I guess, the food chain in the Western society changed to the way it is, we all become almost a different species in that respect. Now that moves us into this whole idea of mercury in our mouths, and even just, you know, it's in other parts of the environment also too. But you alluded to the idea in some of your work, this whole idea of mercury. Not only is it a deleterious as an element, but in compounding the whole problem, the amalgam that's also placed in some people's mouths, these things have an electrical charge to them, and in some way you say this affects the entire body, not just the presence of the mercury, but the electrical charge or the negative charge that it has. Talk to us about that for me, because I'm fascinated by that idea.
Yes, I mean, metals in the body are a really bad idea, in my opinion. You know, metals in the mouth are a bad idea. Amalgam's bad on all sorts of fronts. What it is it's a combination of about half liquid mercury and half powdered metals, copper, silver, tin, and it's mixed together. It actually never sets properly to become a solid. It's not a proper amalgam that has to be, you know, heat treated. Mm-hmm. So what you get is a very thick oatmeal porridge sort of thing with all these granules of the powdered metals, and then the surface reacts, but you've basically got a kind of thick sludgy mercury base. And what happens when you put dissimilar metals together is that they react electrogalvanically and produce a current. So first of all, the filling just taken in isolation produces a current, and that actually causes the mercury to vaporize, because mercury is the only metal that is liquid at room temperature and can vaporize at room temperature as well. And then that's inhaled, into the lungs and then distributed around the body, and it's also swallowed. And then you also get corrosion products and they're swallowed. Yes, you've got energy meridians. This is the true nature of the body, is energetic. Mm-hmm. You've got energy meridians running through the body, and all of the energy meridians run through the teeth. And if you've got just a lump of metal sitting on a meridian, it's probably at least partially or maybe totally blocking the energy flows in that meridian. But if you've got an amalgam filling in the wider context of a mouth, so you've got saliva, which is an electrolyte. You've got gold crowns in there. You've got cobalt chromium dentures. You've got, all sorts of, we use 17 different metals in the mouth. You've then got really complex electrogalvanic currents being discharged between, your gold crown and your amalgam filling and your post and all the rest of it. So you're actually electrostimulating the meridians, but just kind of chaotically, like a mad acupuncturist. So that's a couple of the reasons that metals are really bad, and mercury is particularly terrible.
So for those people who have bridge work in that are foundationally, the new enamel or whatever, the new tooth structure is based on some sort of metal bridge work. What is that metal made out of?
Yes, a lot of people think that their crowns, particularly on back teeth, are all ceramic, but the chances are, unless they particularly requested that or the dentist has particularly made a point to them that that was all ceramic, the chances are that they're not. Their chances are that it's porcelain bonded onto a metal base for strength.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit of a movable feast, what they're made of, but they certainly often contain nickel, which is a carcinogen, and 10% of women are allergic to nickel. They contain all kinds of things. Some precious metals, there'll be some platinum and some gold or silver, but they, obviously that's expensive, so they try to reduce the quantities of that. But it has to work, mechanically so that it retains the porcelain, but that there's all sorts of different formulas there. But I must say, when I first kind of got into all of this, I had my amalgam fillings removed by a biological dentist, and I actually got through that without too much trouble. But when I actually then cottoned on to the whole metal thing and went back and had my metal crowns removed and had them replaced with ceramics, I had, I felt terrible. And blood tests just last year show that I'm allergic to 13 different metals, all of them, well, either in my own mouth or, I was occupationally exposed to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually quite common, and it's particularly common in women, probably because we wear jewelry and have pierced ears and things like that, so we get sensitized to metals more than men.
Now, you said you had some of these things removed, and I know quite a few people that I know have had them removed. I know someone who was talking to me, and I was indicating to them that I'd be talking to you on the show this evening, and her dentist indicated to me that if the mercury is removed in the way they remove it, it somehow affects the structure of the tooth and makes the tooth less viable. Not only in that, the vapors are also exposed to the body. Should someone have them removed? You said you had them removed. At what degree of risk is there if you do go and get your mercury fillings removed?
Well, there is a risk, and you do need to be informed, and actually that's the topic of my book, The Natural Recovery Plan. It addresses the whole issue of toxic metals in dentistry and their safe removal and detoxing your body of the accumulated metals. So if you want, chapter and verse on that, refer to that. It's very important that the fillings be removed safely by a biological dentist. There is, even with the best will in the world and even with the dentist trying to protect you, when the dentist drills on the filling, there is a massive release of mercury vapor that is the patient is exposed to, and so it's the dentist and their staff.
Now, run by me again what you mean by a biological dentist. Just run that by us again.
Right, this is a kind of term that's gaining currency. There's a whole spectrum. Some dentists get that mercury, inserting mercury in your teeth isn't a good idea, and they're mercury-free or mercury-safe and or mercury-safe dentists. and they do that. At the other end of the scale, you've got dentists who maybe have trained as naturopaths and, you know, homeopaths and things like that as well, and they actually really look at the effect that dental work is having on the health of the body, and they often end up treating quite seriously sick people. You know, they get people with cancer and multiple sclerosis and all that sort of thing wanting what is called total dental revision, which is getting all of the dental tissues sorted out, so getting all the metals out, removing all the root canal filled teeth, things like that, and possibly even implants if there's an issue around that, and dealing with what are called cavitations, which are old extraction sites that never healed properly. So it is really important that you'd go and see a biological dentist. There's an organization called the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, IAOMT, I think it's .org, and they have a listing of appropriately trained dentists. Mm-hmm. In Canada, I think, as well. But don't stint on this because, you know, I've seen so many people. I advise them. They say, well, I can't afford it. They've gone somewhere else. And, you know, they'll be sick for months, but, you know, maybe not even recover and, you know, maybe even worse than that. So it is really important that that is done safely. And that's not something that the organization, you know, the American Dental Association, they're not going to concede this probably unless they're absolutely forced, as with smoking. You know, it took them 40 years.
Of course, yeah.
That it was an issue, or asbestosis, or whatever.
Of course.
So, you know, I'm absolutely convinced they know, but, you know, it's just such a hot potato, they can't touch it, really. And they've taken such a strong stand over the decades that they can't, you know, say anything without losing face.
Mm-hmm. How challenged are you by the dentistry profession, in either collectively or individually, about your views on that, on this whole idea, and your website? And did you receive much critique about the work that you do and the way you're challenging the presuppositions that you were taught initially?
Well, you know, the knee-jerk response is, oh, there's no evidence. And, you know, the people saying that may have been taught that, and they may actually believe that, but they're wrong. You know, I've spent 12, 14 years reading the research papers, and you can't read all of that research and, of course, my personal experiences of being mercury poisoned and recovering. You can't, you know, you can't go back to believing anything else. And once you can actually see it, because we've been using this stuff for 200 years, it was introduced without testing. And also, there's quite a lot of mercury, or certainly has been historically, in vaccinations. So, you know, the thing is, asbestosis is terrible, but it dies with the person. The thing about mercury poisoning is it gets passed on from generation to generation by the mother in the womb and in the breast milk, and it's believed that mm-hmm. between a third and two-thirds of the mother's toxin burden gets passed on to the offspring. So, you know, we are now looking at, you know, we're generations into this mercury poisoning of humanity, really. And, you know, once you actually know what you're looking at, it gets locked into the central nervous system. I would say that, you know, autism, Alzheimer's, multiple mm-hmm. sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's, all of those sort of disorders, Parkinson's, if not exclusively mercury, there's a very large element of mercury poisoning involved there. And indeed, both my parents have gone, I think, with mercury poisoning. They've both ended up with Alzheimer's and dementia for prolonged periods. And my father went deaf and blind and what have you as well. So I'm keen to avoid the same fate.
Of course, yeah. You're very motivated in that way. Mm. Your website, it's called, you know, Mouth Body Doctor. You mentioned in one of the segments of your website, as the mouth being considered by most people in the medical practice, the mouth is a separate entity from the rest of the body.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of other kind of talk that, you know, from some naturopaths that they can, you know, look at your nails and discover what kind of problems you may have health-wise. People will look at your eyes or even your skin tone. How does the mouth in itself, it's a very complex part of your body, how does that tell a practitioner what your body type is?
Right. Well, this whole system has worked by division and separation, I think, the current paradigm. So dentists, you know, deal exclusively with the mouth. They're not allowed to deal with anything below the mm-hmm. neck. You know, doctors don't get taught practically anything about the mouth. So if there's any oral problems, they kind of, you know, give antibiotics or something or refer them on.
Refer them on, yeah.
So So there's no, you know, there's no cross-fertilization of ideas between those two disciplines for a start. And then, you know, of course, you get different specialities within medicine and dentistry, so it gets even crazier. So you've got endodontists, orthodontists, and all this sort of thing. So none of them are seeing the big picture. Yes, fingernails, you know, do reflect the health of your body because they are, you know, constantly being reformed, and also because they are not an essential part of your body. I think the body allocates resources elsewhere. So you can tell, yes, definitely, from somebody's fingernails what kind of, you know, if you've got good, strong fingernails, chances are you're in good, you know, in pretty good, robust health. The mouth. The mouth is important. People who know about these things and who are able to detect the connections say that 90% of disease actually either originates in or is made worse by the status of the mouth.
Yeah, doctor, we're going to have to hold you there just for a second. We have to take a very brief break. Fascinating conversation about the health of your mouth. in any case, you're listening to this to The Conspiracy Show, and my name is Victor Vigiani. Stay right where you are. And we are back to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Victor Vigiani. I want to just bring you up to date on a few things that Richard Serrett, our regular host, is up to. One of the really interesting things that Richard has been doing is television. He's getting into that medium more and more. And what he's done lately is his new show, The Conspiracy Show on Television, will be debuting across Canada on Vision TV on August the 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. There'll be 13 brand new episodes. I think that's exactly what Richard's doing over this the next couple of days, is doing some of this work. And these episodes will include the fake Arab Spring, Stanley Mayer's Water Engine, The Shroud of Turin, and Is the Cure for Cancer Being Suppressed? So keep an eye out for that kind of thing happening on Vision TV beginning August the 11th at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Also, if you want to become a member of Richard.com, it's quick and easy and it's free. Just click on the blue membership area log on his website, RichardSerrett.com, and fill in the required fields and wait for your confirmation by email. If by chance you don't receive it, check your spam folder by just clicking on your spam folder, and perhaps it's hiding there under a different name. And once you're a member, you can gain access to member-only areas of the website, like past show archives, etc. And you'll receive the Dead Drop newsletter. I was going to say Drop Dead, but it's not that. It's the Dead Drop newsletter, the official newsletter of The Conspiracy Show. Now, before we also go on, I'd like to mention one of the things happening here just north of Toronto coming up at the end of August, August 28th to 31st. It's called the Extraterrestrial Intelligence and Consciousness Cosmic Connection. It's a retreat just north of Toronto. And if you want to find out more about this retreat, you can go to ufocontact.com/retreat, and you'll be looking at all kinds of information about how to sign up for that retreat. The guest speakers will be Daniel P. Sheehan, Canadian Grant Cameron, Stephen G. Bassett, and just maybe myself. I might show up there too to contribute to that evening. That's the Extraterrestrial Intelligence and the Consciousness Connection later on in August. This evening, we are speaking with the mouth and body doctor. I guess we're going to have to call it that for now, because it's a great way of describing what our guest is all about, Dr. Allison Adams, a qualified dentist who has been sort of, turned around in her profession by a number of personal experiences and investigation. Before the break, doctor, you were talking about how the mouth has been considered a separate part of the body by practitioners. And I guess the way that's happened, it's because I guess everything in our life, and particularly medicine, has become so compartmentalized versus holistic. How far along the whole continuum are we as a generation in understanding that medicine is much more holistic instead of the compartmentalized discipline that we've been brought up to believe?
Well, this has to come, but it's still a challenge because you've been inducted into the other system. And, you know, still sometimes I find myself, you know, going back into the old way of thinking and then thinking, oh, no, you know. But, the thing is that we have to join the dots. You were just talking in the break there about cancer, and 97 to 98% of people in studies who've got cancer have had root canal fillings. And a study by Thomas Rau at the Paracelsus Clinic in Switzerland found that the majority of those for women who had breast cancer, for instance, were on the meridian associated with the breast. So a lot of the diseases we're thinking of as incurable at the moment, we're thinking of as incurable because we haven't removed the cause or one of the, you know, perpetuating factors. The fact is the teeth are organs, and we were talking about fingernails, and the teeth are like fingernails. They're actually like bone in that they're constantly remodeled and rebuilt, it's a dynamic thing. And dentists don't think like that. You know, we're always carving up teeth. We don't think of them as being living things, but they are. And in fact, they have a system of a fluid flows that come out of the tooth, which are actually supposed to provide a protective shield for the tooth. That are controlled by your diet and what have you. And when we eat this kind of devitalized diet in the West, that the fluid flows reverse, and that's when all the problems start with gum disease and tooth decay. So it's a kind of a two-way thing. Gum disease, if gum disease gets a toehold, then the bacteria there can spread throughout the rest of the body. They can go to the heart and, you know, the joints and that sort of thing. It can affect the meridians. If there is actually, for instance, an organic problem with, say, the gallbladder or something, that may manifest as decay or a gum disease around, in that particular case, the canine or the cuspid tooth.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to look at the whole picture, and this is what biological dentists do at their best.
Okay. So how long would you figure it'll take sort of traditional dentistry, you know, dentistry 101 to move on from their traditional, I guess, straitjacket and into this? You said it's going to take time. What's propelling people in the dentistry profession to move along the continuum to look at the more holistic idea?
There's nothing.
Really? My goodness.
Really,
we're in bad shape. Allison.
You know, some of this. I mean, when amalgam was introduced, there was a huge big row about it, and there was, there was what was called the first amalgam war in the States. And this is, you know, we're talking about 160, 70 years ago, and, you know, the debate still rumbles on. There's been a couple of real attempts to expose the problem, but it just always seems to go to ground. It meets a load of denials, official denials, and goes to ground again. And then, you know, issues like cavitations, which are these improperly healed extraction sites, they were first described by the father of modern dentistry again, you know, easily over 100 years ago. And still there's no acknowledgement of that. The research work into the problems that root canal fillings pose, that was all done 80 years ago, 90 years ago by Weston Price and his research team. And again, that's all kind of, you know, been covered up. And, you know, so I think when it comes, it's going to come suddenly, a bit like the fall of the Berlin Wall
That.
You know, it's got to happen.
Yeah. Going to have to take another break here, Anya. And great talking to you. And we'll continue our conversation on The Conspiracy Show right after the break. My name is Victor Vigiani. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Allison Adams about your mouth and what's in it and what it might lead to if you don't take care of it properly. And it sounds like from how we're going, it's, I would say, 98% of the population that's listening to this program right now, if not resident in North America, are suffering from some kind of effects of this, or potentially they might be. A while back, I had a guest on, Dr. Magda Havas, talking about electromagnetic poisoning coming from the internet routers and different types of computers and so on. So we're surrounded by that, and the smart meters that are on the sides of our houses here in North America, and also too, things like aluminum and deodorant. I have a really big growing problem with all of that, in that I'm sort of the opinion that as human beings, we are engaged in a whole series of extinction behaviors that eventually are going to rub us out from the face of the planet. And that's not a pretty scenario. But we seem to be ignoring some of the more specific things that we need to do to release ourselves from this kind of stuff. Is this a political thing? I mean, looking at it in the wider context, Allison, is there some sort of, as we mentioned, is some sort of conspiracy that we are just built in to ignore this stuff and we're just sort of destined to become extinct? Or is there a way out of this? It's a tough question, but I'd like you to take a stab at it.
Yes, one of the things that bothered Weston Price was that 22 civilizations had risen and fallen in the last 6,000 years, and he felt that, you know, unless we sorted out, looked at why and what had happened, we were destined to repeat the pattern. And, you know, I very much, I'm on board with you there. You know, I think we are heading towards over the precipice unless we do something. And, of course, all the time being met with denials, and it's all about money at the end of the day. You know, that the reason that you don't know about the dangers of Wi-Fi is because it's a huge, it's now the leading earner in the world, isn't it?
Of course,
you know,
yeah.
And these, but, you know, the other thing is that these subjects tie in with one another. I've actually got another website, thenaturalrecoveryplan.com, and I've got quite a lot of information there about the dental stuff as well, but also Wi-Fi and all the kind of bigger dangers as well. Of course, the metals in your mouth act as antennae for electromagnetic radiation.
She was saying that, yeah.
Yeah, and also, as I say, the mercury actually gets distributed around your body, and every molecule of mercury will act as an antenna as well within your body. So you are an antenna anyway, because you're just, you know, a hairy bag of salty soup, speaking personally. So, you know, but the metals certainly, and things like if you have an MRI scan or whatever, if you're actually subjected to intense electromagnetic radiation, you know, we know that your fillings emit more mercury, a third more in that case. And yes, if you use your mobile phone, that, you know, promotes more mercury vapor release and all the rest of it. So, yes, I mean, I live in the countryside, but I venture into London occasionally, and I'm just appalled and horrified by the fact that people just obviously have no idea. You know, they're on their phones 50% of the time, it seems. They've got them in their hands or in their pockets all the time. And, you know, no awareness of safety or that there might be a hazard because they've not been told about it, you know, and it's been denied. But I don't have Wi-Fi, or I do have a Wi-Fi router, but I turn it off. I don't have I have a mobile phone, but I only use it if I'm meeting somebody, you know, that sort of thing. I'm very aware. I just had, I actually posted a video about it, but I had my house surveyed for EMF and, you know, took the measures they suggested to rectify. So there are things you can do, but yes, I don't know what the smart meter program is like in Canada, but, you know, I think they're going to start rolling it out here next year.
Yeah, there was one German individual who I corresponded with, and he's involved in his own program in Germany of suggesting to hydro companies that electric companies that they get rid of their smart meters, and he has one approach that has proved to be very successful. He takes a sledgehammer to his smart meter and says, "My goodness, somebody destroyed it. Better come and replace it with something." And it's a rather revolutionary way of dealing with a problem, but it does get fixed in that way.
Apparently, if you do that three times, they won't bother replacing it.
Well, I guess you try all kinds of things. For just a second here, there's a lot of our listeners out there, be they mothers or fathers, new mothers or fathers, new parents. They've got children either, you know, very, very young or on the way. What advice would you have for them in their first little foray once the child begins to enter the realm of visiting a dentist? Where would they go? What should they do? What should they look for?
Right. Well, I think a lot of this is about taking things into your own hands. Don't expect a dentist to fix the problems. You've got to do it. And that starts with the mother's breastfeeding. That is so important because the actual action of suckling as opposed to sucking on a bottle, which the suckling actually spreads the jaws and promotes proper development of the temporomandibular joint, whereas sucking on a bottle actually, they suck the cheeks in and that collapses the arch. And this is why we've got this huge problem with kids, you know, a vast majority of kids needing braces when they're older.
So you're saying that, hang on a second now, you're saying that the act, I never realized this, that the act of sucking on a nipple from a bottle is different from a mother's breast. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, suckling on a nipple, the child works the tongue against the palate, and that spreads the jaws. It's all a beautifully designed, you know, cohesive system, and we interfere with it at our peril. If you give a child a teat on a bottle, they suck the cheeks in, and that collapses dental arch. So this is why, as I say, you need orthodontics. This is why our jaws aren't developing, and we're, you know, many people need their wisdom teeth out, et cetera, when they're older. facial development, most of it happens in the first year of life. That's when, because the baby is born with, you know, quite a big brain, relatively, but their face is quite underdeveloped, and a lot of that growth happens in the first year of life, and 90% of it's done by the time they're six, actually. So all that early care is really important. I would say what you wean the child onto is terribly important. What you feed the child is terribly important. What you want to do, not that you shouldn't take your child to the dentist, but when you take your child to the dentist, they shouldn't need anything doing, but that's down to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been misinformed about what a, quote, healthy diet is. I would say you want to have a nutrient-dense diet. So don't give your child processed foods. Don't give them sugar. Don't give them, you know, refined stuff. You need, don't give them cereal and toast for breakfast. Give them scrambled eggs or bacon and eggs. They need the actual, they need the vitamins in the animal fats. And this was one of the main findings of Weston Price's work. You know, so what we think of as a normal diet, again, this word normal, you know, which the doctors always say, oh, just eat normally. Well, you know, that's what made you sick in the first place, you know. So when you really get that, you may be motivated to make the changes. But eat, the advice is an ancestral diet, stuff your, you know, great-great-grandparents would recognize and eat. Mm-hmm. So eat from nature's table. That's the thing, because those are vital foods. Try and eat in season. And as I say, don't be scared of animal fats, quite the reverse. Include butter, yellow butters in your diet, include raw milk if you can get hold of it, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I've run into a couple of situations of female friends of mine and acquaintances that have had different types of thyroid difficulties in terms of, you know, weight gaining, memory loss, sleep issues, different glandular problems. How relative or related to that might the dental issues that we're talking about, or is there a relationship at all?
I think there's a very strong relationship. The mercury accumulates in the endocrine glands, firstly, I think, because they're just very dynamic organs. Secondly, because they have lots of receptors for essential minerals such as selenium and zinc and that sort of thing, which can attract mercury, which then binds. Also, just because of their geographical, if you like, position, so that all the circulation and the lymphatics from the mouth are actually intercommunicating with that in the thyroid. Mercury is a heavy metal, and it's called that for a reason, because it's 13.5 times heavier than water, so it sinks in body compartments, so it sinks into the lower jaw, for instance. So, yes, I think very much that amalgam fillings are a big part of the disabling thyroid function. And also, I would say, going back to our earlier topic, but Wi-Fi and things like that, because once the metals are in the organ, then, you know, it's being... you get all kinds of free radical damage and things when it's exposed to electromagnetic fields. So I think that's a big part. And I also think diet is a big part as well. I think it may be a bit more dynamic than we think. But, you know, I think you do have to eat fats and animal products and organs. This organ meats, this is what Weston Price found. And for thyroid, it's no soy, no beans, no nuts, no seeds, really, and no cruciferous vegetables. So that's cabbage and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts and things like that. They're all what are called goitrogens, which are known to destroy thyroid function. And the other cause as well, I should just add, is that mercury attaches to what's called the histocompatibility complex on the cell wall. And what that does is it's a bit like a barcode, and it changes the barcode, and then the body doesn't recognize the thyroid as self. It recognizes it as non-self, and that's when you get autoimmune problems. So things like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, where the body attacks the thyroid, believing it to be foreign tissue. So I think it's all very tied in, and I have a thyroid problem myself.
What were the vegetables you said that should be avoided?
For people with thyroid issues, soy products. I don't like soy products anyway. I don't think anybody should be eating them, but particularly if you've got a thyroid problem. The cruciferous vegetable family, so and that's cabbages, cauliflowers, Brussels sprouts, that sort of thing. That does a more extensive list. You'll have to look
of
that
course,
one up.
Yeah.
Nuts and seeds and beans and pulses. So, you know, kidney beans and chickpeas and that sort of thing.
Wow.
And just generally, you need to nourish your thyroid as well. A lot of us are mineral deficient, so a lot of people aren't getting sufficient iodine, for instance. And that ties in. Iodine is actually a halogen that's essential to thyroid function.
Right.
But using fluoride and fluoride toothpaste, putting fluoride in the water, putting chlorine in the water, those are more reactive halogens and they displace iodine.
Yeah.
So you need to, you know, filter your water and use fluoride-free toothpaste and all that sort of thing as well. So it's, you know, you need to attack it from several, you know, aspects, really.
Sounds like a full-time job.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's your health on the line and not having to take drugs for the rest of your life. And
yeah.
I mean, there's no comparison between, you know, taking exogenous hormones and having your own system work properly.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Doctor, for joining us this evening. Once again, your website, www.mouthbodydoctor.com. Please have a look at it. And I'm looking at it right now, and it's sort of a fitting way to end. And you can comment if you wish briefly. Albert Einstein said only two things are infinite: the universe and human stupidity. And then he goes on to say, "I'm not so sure about the former." And it's kind of a good thing to understand about our human condition, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
He wasn't wrong
for sure. In any case, thank you so much for joining us. Perhaps we can continue this conversation. There's a lot of other things that we can talk about around this issue, but I do want to thank you for this evening. It's been a joy having you with us, and we'll talk to you again soon again.
Thank you, Victor.
Okay, now. Well, that would be about it, folks, for this evening. On behalf of Richard here at The Conspiracy Show, I want to thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure being in the big chair this evening. And I do want to thank Richard for that opportunity and wish him well in his upcoming TV programs on Vision TV. And we hope to join you soon again. Be sure to listen in to Richard Serrett next Sunday at the same time and the same station, as they say in the vernacular. Once again, you're listening to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Victor Vigiani. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.